like to start by saying I'm a physiotherapist. I've got a clinical and research background looking at gait rehabilitation and generally about the science of gait and the kind of biological basis of it. And body structures, activity, participation are my bread and butter. Phenomenology isn't, but it's been a really useful tool for me to try and understand more about the walking experience of the patients that I've dealt with. And I was very glad to sort of come to phenomenology in the second half of my PhD. I press the button and it should change. Yeah. So my PhD is actually consisted of two phases, and I'll begin by telling you a little bit about phase one of it, which is a quantitative trial, because it shows you the background of why I needed the phenomenology to increase my understanding of walking as a phenomenon for these participants. So phase one was the feasibility of combining physiotherapy and electrical stimulation to improve gait in patients who were less than 6 months post-stroke. And I started that research in 2007. So the equipment that we use is that at the bottom. There's a small stimulator that's worn on the body, about the size of a pack of playing cards, connected by leads at the moment, although there are some wireless versions, to some electrodes that sit on the muscle. And they're timed into the walking pattern by the little foot switch that's worn under the heel. You may have seen similar technology on the Andrew Marr show. He's got one of these that helps him after a stroke. So this is called functional electrical stimulation, but I'll shorten it to FES during my talk. That's my specialism. That's what I've spent 10 years researching. I've helped to design some of this equipment. The patients that we see are massively helped by this. The electrodes are usually placed on the muscles that lift the foot during walking, and I'll show you some video of the effects of that shortly. So often when patients are walking, they scuff their toes and it makes them feel like they're going to trip over, but when they use this kind of equipment, it lifts their toes clear of the floor. My initial research was funded by the Stroke Association and completed in Salisbury District Hospital. And it became the beginning of what was going to be a master's but turned into a PhD from Southampton University. An overview of that phase one method is that it was a 20-week process. They had 6 weeks of therapy, physiotherapy, and it was a small feasibility study. So actually I was the physiotherapist in this trial as well as the researcher, which got a whole load of different questions to raise. But participants were randomised at the beginning, went into the two groups, either had physiotherapy on its own or physiotherapy with this electrical stimulation incorporated. Their outcome measures were redone at the end of the period. They then had some follow-up time where they weren't in the physiotherapy and they were assessed again at 20 weeks. The kind of assessments that we were doing in those assessment sessions are walking speed, 6 minute walking distance, the Rivermead Mobility Index, which is a questionnaire about walking, so it's got 15 questions. Can you roll over in bed? Can you sit on the side unaided? Can you stand up on your own? Can you run? That's the kind, it goes from those extremes. Visual gait analysis is a kind of list of 60 questions when you watch somebody's walking. Can they lift their foot? Can they bend their knee? Is their weight over their hip in the normal way? So they're the kind of technical questions. And the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure is an interesting outcome measure. It's not very often used in physiotherapy and general gait rehabilitation, but I think it probably ought to be used more often because it asks people, what are the important aspects of your life, your day? How do you feel about your performance in those and how satisfied are you with your performance? So it's their self-selected activities, whereas most outcome measures are imposed activities on the person. But the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure asks them about what's important to them. So these are the ones that I chose for my study, and they were done in the context of the WHO, the World Health Organization's International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, where some of my title for this talk comes from. And that divides us up into our own body structures and functions, and that when there's a problem with those, we call it impairments, activities such as walking, and participation. So if we thought about ourselves with, say, a twisted ankle, you might have an impairment of your ankle ligament that leads to a restriction, an activity limitation in walking, so limited walking in your home or roundabout, and leading to a participation restriction such as not being able to work or going and do the exercise that you enjoy doing. That all happens within the context of our lives with environmental factors taking part. So if you twisted your ankle and you live up a mountain, that may be more problematic than if you live in, say, in an urban environment, perhaps. And also personal factors. So if you are already depressed, twisting your ankle may change your world differently to if you have a very buoyant sense of self. So that's the World Health Organization's terminology. It's supposed to be all-encompassing, and when we choose outcome measures for research, we're supposed to consider outcome measures at the various levels. So in that good practice sense, those outcome measures that I've just described to you that I used in my phase one research, they've got different bits of that model incorporated in them, activities, impairments, as well as activity and participation outcome measures. So that's why I felt quite pleased with it. But there were some issues, and we'll come to those in a second. First of all, I'd like to show you a video of one of the participants. Oh, wait a second. Back. Where do I go? Back. The back. There it is. Just needs to stop. So what you should be able to see in this video is the lady at the start of the trial. So her stroke, she'd not long got out of hospital at this point. And she's obviously got difficulty moving her left leg. You can see that her left arm is hanging by her side. She's got hemiplegia, so her left arm is also paralysed. She's got problems lifting her foot up, problems clearing the floor, and her entire effort is focused on standing up, staying up against gravity, and not falling over in this video. She doesn't have space for a conversation while she's walking. There's just not enough cognitive resource left. Walking takes too much. This is her after the physiotherapy period. I'm not standing quite so close to her as I was at the beginning. Her balance has improved. She's using a stick. She's less dependent. And this is her walking without the stimulation switched on. You can see that she's able to lift her foot, but there's that characteristic curve under of her foot because of she's got high tone with her stroke. I'm going to start the other video. And that's with the stimulation switched on, and you can see her ankle's more stable, there's less of that twisting under, and that changes her experience of walking dramatically. She chose to use the stimulation on every step she took all day, every day, because she felt more stable and more able to do the things that she wanted to do when she had the stimulation on to help her. This is her at week 20. I'm nowhere near because she's that stable. And this is her with the stimulation. And you can see there's a difference in her speed of walking. She wouldn't describe either of them as pretty, but they're a lot better than they were at the beginning of the study. And the second part of my work interviewed some of the people who took part in this study. So this is within the first 6 months after their stroke. My interviews took place about 3 years after their stroke. So we'll come on to that. So the conclusions of this phase one study are that those outcome measures were feasible and the protocol was feasible, that they had a consistent improvement, as you saw in those videos, during the treatment phase that was maintained or increased in follow-up. And when the FES was switched on, they walked a bit faster, which is not a great surprise when what you do is FES, but that's what the study did find. And that a fully powered study would need 144 people because you're looking at small changes in their walking. So that was just a bit of background. The thing that I found, though, was that the participants in my first phase of the research talked a lot about walking. They talked about what they missed about walking, what they hoped to do in the future, what was important to them about walking. But that wasn't fully captured by the outcome measures that I was using, however hard I tried to make them as good as I possibly could and as broad as I could. And so that was the project driver, really, for the second phase of my research, which I called Talking About Walking. So TAW, Talking About Walking, research questions were, how do people who've had a stroke affecting walking, who have taken part in gait rehabilitation, describe their walking and how it's changed over time since the stroke? And what aspects of walking do they value? How have these changed since the stroke? Because looking at the literature, nobody's ever asked people what they value about walking, whether they've had a stroke or not. It's just not there in the literature. And walking's such a sort of basic part of most of our experiences, and mobility, if you count people who are using wheelchairs and things like that, such a basic part of our experience that it's a big gap in the literature, to be honest. We spend a lot of resources helping people walk, but we know very little about what people value. We also wanted to know, I wanted to know, about how people describe their experiences of using assistive devices. So I'm going to give you a little summary of my data collection. So the participants were people who'd had a stroke that affected their walking. I recruited them from a university database, and some of the people who'd taken part in the phase one study were on that database, so I looked for those people specifically. It was approved by Southampton University Ethics Committee. And the four interviews, there were four people on the database who were eligible to take part, and they all agreed to. And the interviews were done in their own homes or in a place of their choosing where they felt comfortable. They were transcribed by an audio typist, because I would have spent my life trying to transcribe them otherwise. Each one was about an hour and a half long, and that was a lot of words to analyse for me. So they were transcribed by an audio typist, but I checked them line by line against the recordings to make sure it was accurate. This is a summary of the participants. I asked them to choose their own pseudonyms. My recommendation is never do that. I got Jim and Jim Bob. So kind of I apologise for that. They're their own symbols, pseudonyms. 10 minutes, thank you. So pre-stroke, Jim worked as a tiler. He was divorced, he lived in a small town, lived alone, he enjoyed pub sports like darts and pool and going fishing. Obviously fishing isn't a pub sport, but you know what I mean. Jim Bob was 55. These two were both in the physiotherapy only group of my study. So Jim, that's why the A is after them in group A. Jim Bob was married, lived with his wife, also with his grown up, well, adult daughter, she was at university. He was a pastor in a local church, and he enjoyed church activities, singing, playing the guitar, all those sorts of things in his urban, he lived in a city, small city, so he lived in an urban environment. Liz, 51, she was in the FES group, so she used FES during the trial. She's a mother of two teenage sons when she had her stroke. Before her stroke, she was working full-time, enjoying active outdoor pursuits like tennis, riding, she had her own horse, and also walking. Rosa was the oldest of my participants, 85. She didn't use FES during the trial, but she used it later through the clinic run by the NHS. Widower, living alone, living close to family in a small village, was actively retired, volunteering, gardening, walking, and enjoying bowls and dancing. I used interpretive phenomenological analysis. Now, I kind of came to this with a question and then was looking for a way of trying to understand these people's experience, and that's how I came to phenomenology. But I needed some way into it as a non-philosopher, a non-phenomenologist, a non-everything. And IPA made sense to me. It's been developed by Smith et al. It focuses on how the phenomenon appears, how the analyst makes sense of that appearance, and the meaning of the phenomenon for that particular individual in their context. And it encourages you to adopt that phenomenological attitude, putting aside your previously held habitual ways of thinking about the phenomena that you're investigating, which for a physio is quite hard when you're thinking about walking. But I tried to. So I went through a process of initial noting, lots of readings of the text, looking for descriptive, linguistic, and conceptual errors and commenting on them, transforming those initial notes into emergent themes, listing the emergent themes, looking for clusters of them that could become bigger themes, and checking for divergency for people who didn't agree, and then making a list of main themes from that first participant, and then doing the whole thing again with each of the participants in turn before bringing those themes together and trying to do an overview set of superordinate themes across all of the cases. Most people, just to show you what page, typical page, that's the transcript, my initial notes to one side, and then the emergent themes to the left. But many people try to do the theme and finding these overarching themes like this, but we were moving house, so I couldn't go and have a whole load of piece of paper across our living room. So I did it on Excel. Now, most qualitative researchers don't consider Excel as a reasonable tool to use. I found it really useful. That's my background. I'm supposed to like Excel. So each of these quotes and that contributed to an emergent theme was put on a line, I wrote the name of the emergent theme and typed in my initial notes, and then kept reordering them by keywords and things like that until I came up with groups and clusters that I could work with. This made a lot of sense to me, and it was free as a kind of program that I could use, but the people who taught me about phenomenology went, well, I've never come across that before. So, apologies, I thought I'd share that with you. So this is my pretty diagram showing you the, brilliant, thank you, the four themes. Now I'm going to have to get a move on now. So, first theme. Has anyone got a yellow card that they would like to share? This is all about valued movement activities and movement attributes. Has anyone got a yellow card that they can read out or want to read out? Somebody put your hand up and start speaking. Right.
If I've got to walk upstairs, I've got to start pull myself up by the handrail, plus hold on, feeling secure, feeling safe.
Yeah. So that's part of this theme about valued movement attributes. And it brings in quite a few of these. So their confidence and safety was an issue for them. They had to do quite a lot of planning. They needed to have a handrail and things like that. It wasn't a spontaneous act. It wasn't automatic. Strength comes into there, as well as their balance and maneuverability. They also valued lots of different types of activities, and not all of those are considered in physio often. So confidence and safety, speed, distance and stamina, strength and balance are often measured, but automaticity, freedom of movement and self-determination aren't. And perhaps that's because these ones on the right are just a bit more difficult to measure. Again, things like moving around your house and washing yourself are usually considered in the NHS, although with the squeeze on our resources, I hope that continues. Down the bottom, returning to sport and occupation may not be so considered. So, in the green or turquoise theme, it's more turquoise on the screen than on your cards. They also talked about being active and taking part, coping with their movement problems by avoidance, adaptation, willing to do it by positive self-talk, and the role of mobility aids and other people in that process. And the activity limitation was multifactorial. Has anyone got a turquoisey teal coloured card that they could read out? Oh, there you go. Yep. And you can picture that from the lady's video that I showed you. She was using a mobility aid to compensate for her mobility problems, her impairments around her ankle. There's quite a lot of research on this, looking at the demand capability gap, various strategies. When the research talks about mobility aids, I liked this quote: "People need to have these devices, but they don't really want to need them. They're not things people want in their lives. Who wants a brace in their shoe and having to choose which shoes they're going to wear because of that?" Large surveys show that people with mobility restrictions often prioritise being self-sufficient over their own physical comfort, and that positive self-talk or self-efficacy, this kind of situation-specific confidence, is really important for people to overcome barriers. Everything becomes a balance between factors that keep you at home and factors that help you to go and leave the house. And you can see the sort of things that are on your cards, contextual factors, environment, things like that that would stop you from going out, and things on the left that would enable you to go out. Moving on, looking at this theme of control, body imbalance control as well as control of a situation. Has anyone got a control card, theme three? Yep.
Nothing's more frightening than falling and not being able to save your face, your head. This dictates what situations I put myself in.
Very clearly, they are changing how they act to control their situation, but that control of body and balance is at the core, at the heart of the reasoning for doing that. Control of body and balance and control of situation. That idea that the body part is thematicised, it may be something that's seen in first-person accounts and in some of the philosophical literature, but it's not part of our physio rehab clinical literature. So I had a participant who said, "You silly thing," I say, "bring your foot with you, don't forget your foot." And it's amazing that this is the kind of talk that people are having to do constantly in order to walk. So it contrasts our natural, taken for granted background role of our body. So I'm standing here, I'm barely aware of my body. I'm concentrating hard on what I'm saying. But if I'd had a stroke, I would also be concentrating on staying upright in front of you. As I say, it's in first person accounts, but it's not in the rehabilitation literature. And this idea of a body that moves from the background in normal function to foreground in illness, but also in skill acquisition. So if you're learning to be a gymnast and you've never been on one of those horse things that we had in the Olympics, you're definitely going to be very aware of your body. Leader is a doctor who wrote about a healthy body that may be transparent in health and recessive. So what I had for lunch is very recessive within my body, and my body is transparent as I'm talking to you now, but will come forward in illness. And Javi Carell, who spoke yesterday, talked about transparency of the body, of social ease, being a characteristic of well-being. So you can see that these people's quotes challenged their well-being. The last one was looking at theme four, which is changing, assessing change by looking at your mobility in the past as a comparator, looking at what mobility aids you used, so maybe starting with a frame, going to a stick, going to nothing, maybe just an ankle brace, and changes in your role and self. And I found it fascinating as a physio because I'd never considered it before because it's not in our literature. People were talking about going from being a protagonist in their lives to being an observer. Has anyone got a changes theme four card that they want to read out? Yep.
I was always fit, physically fit and strong. I didn't doubt myself in terms of my ability to go where I wanted to or do what I wanted to do.
And that goes also back to theme one, which talked about personal freedom. And one man that I interviewed, I'd never heard of this before or even considered, he said that his stroke made him feel a bit like the freedom that Martin Luther King described. He went back to saying, I remember seeing this on television, I am no longer free to do what I want when I want. So it's a radical change in their embodiment. Restricting movement is what Javi Carell says, and inhibiting certain ways of being in the world restricts your bodily movement, your abilities, but also your being in the world. And it's changed how I perceive my patients with stroke and other conditions. I saw them with the lens of a physiotherapist, and by doing the phenomenological work, I was able to look at that phenomena of walking from a slightly different perspective and turn it around a bit and think what it was like from their participants. So there's a mismatch between what we use in rehabilitation as outcome measures and what's valued by people, and we ought to be doing more about this. So I'd like to just thank everyone who took part in my study, particularly the participants, and also you for reading out some of the quotes, the data that was part of my project. So that's it.